This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. And here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Guinea-Bissau has a semi-presidential system, so that further limits the president's power, because parliament also has a very strong say in the framing of the prime minister. Parliament also has a strong power in deciding how government is run.
That's David Monda, professor of political science, American government and international affairs at City University of New York, on Guinea-Bissau's president dissolving parliament. Details coming up also. Britain signed a new treaty on a controversial proposal to send migrants to Rwanda. And South Africa marks the 10th anniversary since the death of Nelson Mandela. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Guinea-Bissau's President Umaro Sissoco Embalo has dissolved the parliament after saying last week that there was an attempt to overthrow the government of the West African country. Embalo cited persistent and unresolvable differences with parliament, which he described as a space for guerrilla politics and plotting. David Monda is professor of political science, American government and international affairs at City University of New York. He tells me that the president dissolving parliament, an important arm of the government, shows instability in Guinea-Bissau.
I think it's a very dangerous aid because it really shows that President Umaro Embalo is looking to consolidate his power. And he's done that by dissolving the parliament. So that's a very important arm of government. In other words, the people can't make laws. The budget can't be decided. So the president is almost, he's going to rule by decree, because a very important arm of government has been, has been dissolved. But I think more importantly, it shows the instability in Guinea-Bissau.
And you are very right, Professor. The former Portuguese colony of about 2 million people is unstable and has suffered four military coups since 1974, most recently in 2012. Talk to us about the politics of Guinea-Bissau over the years.
So the politics has been very difficult, because in 1974, with the assassination of Amilcar Cabral, you already see a process where extra-constitutional means were being used to access power, even back then in 1974. So fast forward till today, we still see the same problem where extra-constitutional means, in this case through coup d'etat, are being attempted by opponents of the president in order to get him out. And this also brings us to the broader question of military coup d'etat contagion, where we've had this whole region of the Sahel, even all the way to Central Africa, to Gabon, where military governments have been taking over power. And now it seems that the contagious effect of coup d'etats in the Sahel has finally also reached Guinea-Bissau.
Professor Embalo has dissolved Guinea-Bissau's parliament in May 2022 after he accused some authorities of corruption and other issues. So this tension between parliament and the presidency have gripped the West African state for months. The president actually has clashed with the parliament over distribution of oil resources at the border with Senegal, about revision of the constitution, and a peacekeeping force from West Africa's regional bloc, ECOWAS. So he's constantly clashing with the parliament.
Very much so. Very much so. And let's also not forget that Guinea-Bissau has a semi-presidential system. So that further limits the president's power, because parliament also has a very strong say in the framing of the prime minister. Parliament also has a strong power in deciding how government is run. And right now it seems this tension between the two heads of the executive, meaning the president and parliament, the heads of the parliament, are really coming forward. And it's a really big struggle.
So moving forward, Professor, presidential decree has said the parliamentary elections would be held on December 18th. What happens to moving forward for Guinea-Bissau?
Right now, it's very difficult to tell. So on one hand, domestically, like we said before, what will the role of the military be, given that the president has decided to rule, essentially he's ruling by decree because he's cut out the legislature. And in addition to that, what will the reaction of the parliament, the members who've been sidelined in the parliament, what will their reaction be? Let's not forget, Guinea-Bissau has had a history of very violent reprisals. At independence, about 8,000 former, African Guinea-Bissau troops refused to join the National Military Army and were summarily executed. That was in the 70s, over 8,000 soldiers. So they've had this history of very violent attempts to take over power. And it's going to be interesting to see where the military will be in the context of this fight between the parliament and detractors of the president on one hand, and then the president Embalo's effort to try and consolidate his position. I think, and lastly, the other interesting element will be, what will the role of the former colonial power and Western interests be in terms of trying to maintain stability in Guinea-Bissau? Will Portugal have an interest in trying to negotiate some kind of settlement there? And then what happens with the ECOWAS, the regional peacekeeping force that already has a hand in Guinea-Bissau?
That was David Monda, a professor of political science, American government, and international affairs at City University of New York. He talked to me from New York. The Israel Defense Forces today said its troops are fighting Hamas militants in the city of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. The United Nations warns the fighting will lead to an even more hellish scenario as civilians are pushed into a shrinking area of the besieged territory. The army began its ground invasion in Gaza's north, sending in troops to destroy Hamas and free hostages taken when the group attacked the Israel communities on October the 7th. The United Nations has said the air and ground assault has displaced about 80% of Gaza's 2.3 million people. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry says nearly 16,000 people have died, most of them women and children. Israel says about 1,200 Israelis and foreign nationals died in the October 7th attacks, and Hamas took about 240 hostages back to Gaza. A week-long truce, which ended last Friday, saw Hamas free more than 100 hostages, while Israel freed 240 Palestinians held in its prisons. Also today, the U.S. news organization Axios reported the United States will issue sanctions as soon as today against Israeli settlers involved in violent attacks against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Social media posts from the actual and ideological battlefields of the Israel-Hamas war have been polarizing young people in the United States, sometimes leading to threats or violence. But some groups see the growing tensions as an opportunity for dialogue. VOA's Anthony Labruto reports.
Never in history has the world been so connected to itself. Especially for young people, social media has provided unrestricted access to information, opinion, and world events. In the Israel-Hamas war, cell phones capture it all. Seeing the good, the bad, and the truly horrific, and not knowing what to do, can be extremely overwhelming when far removed from the situation.
Everybody is just bombarded by a lot of anti-Semitic or pro-Palestinian or pro-Israeli content online. It's like all I get on Instagram Reels. And that can take a mental toll. I would say also, like, it's a really scary situation to be in as a young student.
College campuses around Washington, D.C. have allowed students to find other like-minded people, either on the pro-Israel or pro-Palestine side, who want to take action and compel leaders to do something about the war. What that solution looks like, though, is different on all sides, and finding community has been essential, especially within the nation's capital. Communities of Israelis and Palestinians alike have converged multiple times on the National Mall to express outrage.
I have all of my father's direct relatives in Gaza today.
And you betrayed us.
They have been displaced from their homes. Some of their homes have been bombed.
That's how we feel.
They are living without food, water, electricity, and fuel. Situation is very desperate and devastating. We are awaiting any moment to receive the bad news that their homes have been struck. Our community here, Palestinian-American community, as you can see in the thousands, people have come out to express their outrage.
In a recent report, popular social media application TikTok asserts that the recommendation softwares used in its video streaming are not inherently biased, but note that videos containing the hashtag Free Palestine outnumber those with the hashtag I Stand With Israel by 2.5 million as of November 13th. The social media application also points to long-standing intergenerational research from Pew Research that shows older generations, who are less likely to be present on the app, are more likely to support Israel than younger generations. But other young people see this division of identity online as an opportunity for connection. Maxwell Katz and his business partner, Fareed Abdibi, started Left Middle Right, a digital media organization founded on George Washington University's campus that aims to help college students and other younger people articulate their thoughts.
And I'm sure there are people radicalized on both sides, but the majority are just more involved and are more reflective of who they are and where their roots are. And if both sides just really sign a room, let's say GW for Israel and Students for Justice in Palestine, and they talk for an hour, they'd realize that like they don't hate each other. They don't have an issue with their belief system. It's just a matter of their identities that clash at a geopolitical stage.
While a temporary ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is scheduled to end, social media companies and their users will continue to navigate their own identities in today's interconnected world. Anthony Labruto, VOA News, Washington.
Britain and Rwanda signed a new treaty today in a bid to revive a controversial proposal by London to transfer migrants to the East African country. Rwandan Foreign Minister Vincent Biruta and British Interior Minister James Cleverly signed the treaty in Kigali. Cleverly traveled there to salvage London's stalled bid to send migrants to Rwanda after Britain's Supreme Court blocked an earlier arrangement as unlawful. Many migrant rights activists have expressed concern that Rwanda would not protect the rights and lives of migrants sent there. Cleverly said at a news conference today, "The British government is confident Rwanda is committed to protecting migrants and that the treaty addresses the concerns of the British Supreme Court."
But your country has made a clear and unambiguous commitment to the safety of people who come here. That has been displayed, and we have seen that in practice. You've also made a strong commitment to work with the UK and international partners in order to make sure that the robustness of your judicial system is clearly on display. And we are very proud to be a long-standing partner in that endeavour.
He said his country's goal is to address the causes of migration and protect those who migrate. Cleverly said a key aim to stop what he called evil people smuggling gangs. You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Wahib in Washington. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A new United Nations Environment Program report released today at the COP28 Climate Summit offers key measures to reduce power consumption of cooling equipment that would cut at least 60% of predicted emissions by 2050. Omar Abulaziz, one of the lead authors of the report and assistant professor at the American University in Cairo in the Department of Mechanical Engineering, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that he and others were able to unlock cooling strategies that could take the pressure off energy grids and cut predicted emissions by up to 96% by 2050.
The first thing was to look how to use passive cooling technologies in the building sector and in the cold chain to reduce the demand for cooling, and found out that with the current technologies, we can reduce 24% of the demand by 2050. Then we said, can we use available technologies, energy efficient cooling technologies, to improve the building, the equipment stock? So imagine that cooling is two things. There is a building that you need to cool, and then there is an equipment like an air conditioner that you use to cool the building with. So the first thing is how to make the building more efficient, or to make the building energy efficient, and now how to make the equipment also more energy efficient. And we found out that current technologies are up to 3 times more efficient than what is available on the market. So how can we push the limit and just use the most efficient technologies and have higher market penetration of the high energy efficient technologies? And then can we use lower global warming potential refrigerants and accelerate the phase down of high global warming potential refrigerants? Basically, there is the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, and we want to accelerate the Kigali Amendment.
So let me take the first one. You talk about the buildings. You can do things to make the buildings 25% more efficient. Does that mean you work with existing buildings, or that this is in the future for buildings that will be built?
It's actually a part of both, because we, in the modeling, we accounted for both how we can retrofit current buildings and also future building stock. Imagine that in India, for example, the current building stock is going to double by 2050. So it's like you are building New York City every couple of years. So there is a huge demand growth for buildings in the developing world, right? So we have to be careful and make sure that we are not building stock or building buildings that are not energy efficient. At the same time, how we can make sure that the buildings that are being available right now to us, retrofit it so that we can use cooling and heating more efficiently.
You mentioned in your report that this could especially benefit Africa. How so? What's happening in Africa that you can apply these methods to?
So right now in Africa, access to cooling is very poor. And what we want is maximize the access to cooling and make sure that there is at least one refrigerator for each household. And hopefully there is also one air conditioner for each household, because with extreme heat, you need the cooling to provide livelihood for everyone. This is in 2050. That means you need an additional 3.5 billion people to cover under this cooling initiative. And this is a significant stock of equipment. With the sustainable growth, with reducing the demand, we made way for allowing access to nations in Africa and Asia.
You know, your report's being released in conjunction with the cooling pledge that's being announced today. Are you confident that, you know, most nations will sign on to this cooling pledge and it will be carried out?
So that's what we will see in a few minutes. And that's my hope. I am a hopeful person. And I set on this pathway to write this report because I want to make sure that there is a potential for change. The cooling is an important sector. And if we can make a dent, if we can bend the curve, if we can make sure that people have access to cooling, at the same time, get cooling sustainably by 2050, the world will be a better world.
That's Omar Abdelaziz, assistant professor at the American University in Cairo and one of the lead authors of the new report on cooling. He was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Damme from COP28 in Dubai. Nelson Mandela was a global icon who inspired the world, spending 27 years in prison for his fight against the South African apartheid regime and going on to become the country's first black president. Kate Bartlett reports that 10 years after Mandela's death, former comrades, family, and analysts say he would have been disappointed at the state of South Africa today.
Nelson Mandela, arguably the world's best known and most beloved South African, died a decade ago on December 5, 2013, at the age of 95. His greatest achievement was bringing freedom and democracy to South Africa with his African National Congress, or ANC party, After decades of brutal white minority rule, he forgave his former enemies and ushered in one of the world's most progressive constitutions. South Africa was seen as a moral example and beacon of hope worldwide. Mandela served one term in office. Even before his death, however, while he was in retirement, his once-storied ANC had become embroiled in corruption scandals, most notably under one of his successors, former President Jacob Zuma. Today, critics accuse the party of only caring about self-enrichment and failing to deliver a better life for most of South Africa's impoverished citizens. They say Madiba, as he was widely known, would have been disappointed.
He would have been absolutely appalled at the decay in the country, the continued rampant corruption, including by some cabinet ministers who are members of his once proud African National Congress.
That was Peter Hain, a friend to Mandela and noted anti-apartheid activist whom apartheid security forces attempted to assassinate with a letter bomb in 1972. Many other ANC stalwarts and surviving Mandela contemporaries declined to comment for this story. However, one of the statesman's grandsons, Ndaba Mandela, echoed the view that Mandela would have been disappointed.
Of course, my grandfather Madiba would have been very disappointed, to say the least, to see what's happened with the current ANC, with his party that he loved so much. Do I think some of the party members are letting down the ANC? Of course they are. You have ministers who are on a feeding frenzy.
Lumkili Mondi, an economics professor at the University of the Witwatersrand in Johannesburg, described what he said are the main problems facing South Africa today.
Levels of unemployment are very, very high at about 32.5. More importantly, inequality has deepened. So is poverty. Infrastructure, whether it's water infrastructure, roads infrastructure, electricity infrastructure, has collapsed.
Next year marks 30 years since the first democratic elections in South Africa, and voters will head to the ballot box once again. Numerous polls are suggesting the ANC will lose its majority for the first time. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Hello. This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
A court in Mauritania has sentenced former President Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz to 5 years in prison for abusing his position to amass an ill-gotten fortune. Aziz, who ruled the country between North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa between 2008 and 2019, had a falling out with his successor and current president, Mohamed Ould Ghazouni, a former political ally. The former president had been on trial since January with 10 other prominent figures, including two former prime ministers, for illicit enrichment, abuse of functions, influence peddling, and money laundering. The French news agency AFP says he was convicted of illicit enrichment and money laundering, but cleared of the other charges. The court also ordered the confiscation of Aziz's illicitly acquired assets. In the final moments of his trial, he implicated his successor by claiming Ghazouni gave him two suitcases filled with several million euros the day after his election in 2019. Aziz has been in detention since January 24th and also spent several months in prison in 2021. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Von D, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.